Welcome back to Rockstock Channel. It is Friday, March 8th, here 5:30 a.m. New York time to accommodate timing of my guest here, who is Daisy Jennings Gray for the first time from Benchmark Minerals Intelligence. I was in PDAC earlier this week, and I saw your colleagues, Andy Miller and Ben Ash, and we're like, oh, we haven't had Andy Miller on in a while, but Daisy, we met in November at Benchmark's great November conference, and we tried to do a video then, and you said you couldn't, but anyhow, you are price forecaster, and everyone's interested, of course, in Benchmark's lithium price forecast, so that's going to be the name of this video. Firstly, I'd like to wish you a happy International Women's Day. Very good coincidence that we have a female guest on International Women's Day. And we are going to talk a bunch about the market, and I'm going to have a little bit of an intro here. Before I do that, I just want to thank our sponsor, Lithium Royalty Corp, ticker symbol LIRC, Toronto listed, market cap, 370 million or so Canadian. They have royalties on lithium companies, including Sigma and Winsome. They're going to be reporting their results at the end of this month. And we hope to have Ernie Ortiz, the CEO, join us at sometime soon. We'll have a little bit more to say about that later in the program. And I just want to remind everybody, if you want to get the lithium ion bull to your email box, please register your email at rkequity.com. And if you like these videos, please like, subscribe, and comment. And if you like Daisy specifically and what she has to say at Benchmark, please reference this specifically. And if you have any ideas for other videos, please let us know. You can follow Rodney and me at Lithium Ion Bull. Rodney is at Rodney Hooper 13 on X. Daisy, what's your handle?
At Daisy underscore Benchmark.
Excellent. So before we start, again, I was at PDAC in Toronto, and on Tuesday when I was there, I saw a lot of people, a lot of lithium booths, but in my email box on Tuesday was another new note from Goldman Sachs. I'm a client of theirs, and they also had a webinar, like a 60-minute webinar where I got to see Trina Chen, their Chinese analyst, their Australian analyst, and they also had a capital markets analysts commenting on short positions and the like. And UBS was also out with a note. Citi was out with a note. Macquarie was out with, I think a more bullish note. But the Goldman note, 2 years ago, they called this market, maybe right for the wrong reasons, but said prices would be about where they are, now, 2 years ago. And a Benchmark came out with a rebuttal, I think, 2 years ago as to why that, they were not right. We were also very skeptical about that, but I do want to summarize some of their thoughts, and you don't necessarily have to address them directly, Daisy, but I do want, this is kind of like a Rockstock recap end of Friday analysis, and this was relevant in the market. So Trina, their Chinese analyst, said that, about 160,000 tons of LCE supply cuts have been announced. But 2/3 of this was one mine, I think the Jiangzhou mine that CATL owns. And if that comes back online, which she thinks is likely, the cuts are not that big overall. The environmental inspections in China that we've talked about, or, that have been in the market, are unlikely to be super negative, as they've had similar inspections, just 6 or 9 months ago. And this is not necessarily, directed, at Jiangzhou. They didn't make any comment on the demand side. Their demand numbers for LCE is, I think, 1.1 million. Rodney's is about 1.2 million. So that's a big difference, 100,000 there. But they didn't make any comment about that. It was all about supply. And, we've talked about this. The issue has been, China lepidolite, African supply, and a battery, kind of destock or an over-demand of a battery and cell production that, was whittled down for much of last year. But Trina saw 200,000 tons of LCE coming out of Africa. That's a big number. They also have very significant lepidolite numbers, which, Rodney substantially disagrees with. But another thing that they mentioned, and this is something maybe you can comment as well on Daisy, is that the Australian analyst, this analogy that lithium is like iron ore, which Ken Brinsden, you know, aspires to, I suggested the same, you know, it is potentially a wrong analogy, right? And that aluminum is a better analogy. And his logic for that is that iron ore are just massive investments. Like Jake Hathaway, there's 12 times as much iron ore moved out of Australia than there is in of spodumene. And spodumene is, because they're so big, it's hard to turn on and off iron ore mines or coal mines. But spodumene is easier to switch on and off. And in China, you know, conversion, they've mastered conversion, just like they mastered alumina and aluminum smelting. So if you have, and there's a lot of supply, and there have been major discoveries over the past 12 months, gigantic discoveries, and you see in Africa, you could turn things on a lot faster than, you know, the 10 to 15 year timeline, you know, that we argue it takes in Western markets. So abundant supply, cracking the code on conversion, this could be aluminum. He also said spodumene, you know, 6% or 5.5% is not that complicated either to concentrate. You know, so it's less complicated than a copper and a nickel as well. And copper and nickel and aluminum are all very much commodity markets. So this feeds their narrative that spodumene in particular is a commodity. They're estimating that the cost in Africa is $800, you know, for spodumene. And they're estimating, I think, overall carbonate marginal cost at being, you know, $10 to $12. So their bottom line is that they don't believe in the spodumene, you know, 2000 to 2500 thesis that is needed to, you know, to incentivize supply. In the long, long run, they're suggesting $1,200 spodumene and carbon, I think, around, you know, $12. And finally, they said that for all the thoughts of a short covering, you know, in Pilbara, Core and Liontown, actually, short covering was growing, not shrinking, you know, as of Tuesday. So I'm not expecting you to comment on that last bit, Daisy, but I just found that to be interesting. So with that, Daisy, actually, before I forget, what song, you know, do you think should best embody, you know, either your favorite song or the topics we're going to cover today? You don't need to give an answer to that at the moment if you don't have one, but if you do, go ahead. If not, think about it. And at the end of this, we'll use that for the teaser.
I'll keep it at the back of my mind.
Okay. So Daisy, you don't need to respond directly to the Goldman note, but we do want to focus on one last thing I'll say is that Liontown had to back out of their debt deal or their lenders, you know, declined to follow through because one of your competitors, Woodmac, who is the sole price reporting agency that they relied on for their debt package, lowered their forecast, including a spodumene price of 950 CIF in the 26, 27, 28 time period. So I guess if we could start, Daisy, what is Benchmark's, you know, price forecasts for this year, next year, you know, into the future, for both spodumene, you know, lithium carbonate, and how do you see the supply demand balance unfolding and incentive pricing?
Yeah, of course. So I think, you know, it's been the view for a while that 2024, 2025, 2026 were going to be periods of kind of a more balanced market. We saw huge, huge investment into the lithium space during kind of the price peak in 2021 and 2022. And a lot of, you know, unconventional supply has come to market in that time. You mentioned, you know, supply from Africa, a lot of kind of Chinese domestic supply. And as a result, we do see a more balanced market. I think in 2024 in particular, that's not, you know, in our view, swung to a huge market surplus. It's still kind of a very sensitive market balance that, you know, an uptick in demand driven by cheaper sell prices or, you know, delays to kind of a handful of projects because of the low price environment could quite easily compromise that surplus that we see. as a result, our price forecasts over the next few years are lower than what we've seen over the last couple of years. Naturally, it's a more balanced market. But, you know, we see relative stability kind of hovering around where our view of kind of the price floor is. Definitely in the case of spodumene, you know, I think we still expect to see prices average above the 1,000 mark. There will be some projects that, you know, come under threat at that price level. And naturally, you know, that's why we see kind of marginal supply kind of slitting in and out of the market. We don't see, you know, the high pricing levels that we saw over the last couple of years. But we do still see prices supporting the vast majority of the cost curves because the surplus isn't huge and because a lot of this supply is very sensitive to the price environment. Lithium has an incredibly wide cost curve. You know, not kind of, it's not like every project falls into a very similar basket. Brine, spodumene, traditional spodumene, and then kind of the newer mica projects, and not to mention DLE as well, all kind of fall into their, what is generally own kind of separate cost baskets. There's some overlap, of course, but it's an incredibly wide cost curve. When you look at kind of all the different supply routes. And as a result, we kind of see a similar scenario on the chemical side as well. So I think, you know, we're at a point now where lithium chemicals prices are lower than they've been in a good few years. At the moment, we're actually seeing a little bit of a price rally. I don't think that's going to materialize into, you know, a huge surge in pricing back to the levels that we saw over the last couple of years. But it certainly goes to show that the market is still very, very sensitive to low prices and that you know, there's often very quickly a price response when prices reach certain levels. There's a number of other factors feeding into that at the moment. There's a lot of talk around environmental inspections at Jiangxi. I don't think they're going to be particularly long-lived. We actually see these inspections happen pretty much every year, and there's always kind of a short response. But we are kind of seeing at least slightly more positive sentiment in terms of kind of restocking demand and downstream production heading into Q2 as well. So I think, you know, we see chemical prices hovering in kind of the mid-teens, a bit more stability over the next couple of years. I think, you know, there will be kind of periods of volatility, but generally with a more balanced market, we don't expect to see kind of the huge rises and falls that we saw over, you know, the last couple of years. But seasonality always plays a factor in the lithium market as well. You know, Q4 tends to be very strong. Q1, which is where we are now, always tends to be very weak too. So I don't think, you know, you can form a view on the price environment purely from trends that play out in kind of the first couple of months of the year. Because in a typical lithium market, these are always the weakest months of the year.
Is it just in terms of that sort of pricing outlook, that relative to what Albemarle and others have said is not reinvestment economics. So what does that mean? Are we going to expect to see these alternative forms of supply pick up, or is this the scenes of the next run up in order to get pricing to where people are prepared to put money in the ground?
I think that's a really important point, Rodney, because, you know, the last 12 months of discoveries were definitely fueled by, you know, the 2021, 2022 price increase, which pushed exploration budgets to record highs in the lithium space. And we've kind of seen a lag between high commodity prices, increased exploration budgets play out already. We do still kind of generally hear from the big financial players, the low price environment isn't kind of curtailing investment in future projects. But I think, you know, this message has been hammered home a long time by Benchmark. You know, Simon, Andy, Casper were telling people kind of back in 2018, 2019, And even before that, the investment was needed now to kind of fill the supply gap in the lithium market. And the message wasn't necessarily heard. And we all saw what happened in 2021. And I think, you know, there's a risk of that scenario playing out again. And if you look at our supply-demand scenarios and you look at kind of just existing capacity and the ramp up of existing capacity versus supply that's coming from new projects, those new projects are still very much needed to keep the market in kind of more of a balance or in less of a deficit. And the price has to be at a level where investment is welcome. And I think in addition to that, investment has to be welcomed outside of China if, you know, these Western supply chains want to reduce dependence on the Chinese supply of lithium. Pricing levels have to kind of support the challenges that Western projects are going to face. And, you know, we've seen difficulties and heard of difficulties in the news recently with having to bring Chinese engineering expertise into kind of ex-China refinery projects. We've seen kind of a lot of talk generally over the last couple of years of ex-China supply kind of pushing up the cost curve. And as a result, you know, there's got to be incentive for new supply if the deficit that we're kind of expecting by the end of the decade isn't going to grow even bigger. And if policy expects supply to come from more localized sources.
And tell me, just in this scenario, I'm struggling to see a case for sodium ion at the moment, given these prices and where CATL is talking about cells in the second half and the size of the form factors that they're doing for energy storage and so on and cycle. You know, the cycles are well over 10,000. Your thoughts on how sodium ion is going to find its way in this market?
Yeah, I think, you know, our view at Benchmark has always been that sodium ion will find a place in the market, but it certainly is more economically challenged when the lithium prices are lower. I think, you know, again, talking about that kind of lag between a price environment and rollout in the market, last year we saw a big sodium ion push in response to what had been very, very high lithium prices in 2021. Now, what we see is, you know, much lower lithium prices. And, you know, the pace as a result has kind of slowed in terms of kind of sodium ion uptake and build out generally. I think, you know, in the energy storage market, there will be playoffs between sodium ion and LFP. LFP has obviously made huge waves in China over really the last kind of 4 years or so. And capacity build out has been huge. But, you know, we still see the sodium ion supply chain ramping up. But I think there's always challenges when the lithium price is much lower. And we are seeing LFP cathode and consequently cell costs coming down notably in the market now. In response to what's been happening with lithium prices.
Jumping in here from the editing room to tell you about Lithium Royalty Corp. Lithium Royalty Corp is at the center of a global energy transition and manages a globally diversified portfolio of lithium-focused royalties in electrification and decarbonization. With 32 royalties on 29 higher-grade, lower-cost projects from exploration to production, LIRC covers all the bases with well-managed risk, ESG considerations, and a scalable royalty structure. Lithium Royalty Corp is traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange, ticker symbol LIRC. To find out more, visit lithiumroyaltycorp.com.
Davey, so just to go back to your price forecast, you're saying spodumene prices are going to average around 1,000 or low thousands this year and the coming years? And that carbonate prices are going to be in the low to mid-teens over the next couple of years?
Yeah. So we see spodumene prices over the next couple of years. I would say low to mid-thousands, not quite as low as 1,000. And heading out to the end of the decade, we kind of see prices picking back up. and kind of a long-term incentive price in the mid to high thousands. When you account for that kind of more costly, either non-integrated spodumene production at the chemical level, that kind of feeds through to slightly more elevated long-run incentive chemical prices, and also just back at the upstream kind of unconventional mica supply of hard rock feedstock sources is a higher level than kind of traditional spodumene projects.
Okay, so south of 1500 for the next few years and north of 1500, you know, later in the decade, but not, yep, you know, 2000 or 2500 on the spodumene side. But you say that those prices in the near term, and even just factoring in inflation, you know, later in the year, though, that's not reinvestment economics. So no one's going to invest based on your price forecast, right? Like is an argument what one would argue, right? Because it's not enough, you know, as prices of the spodumene, you know, are increasing. So, and if you want to build Western supply chains, which are significantly higher cost, so then do auto OEMs or US or other governments have to subsidize with price floors higher than your forecast in order to get, you know, companies to supply, you know, or to build, you know, in this market environment? Like on the one hand, you have like GM or Ford, whatever is listening to kind of Goldman Sachs. They're listening to you. They're listening to others. And then on the other hand, the companies are saying, well, I'm sorry, that's not high enough for us to kind of invest. So you need to give me a floor price higher than what Goldman Sachs and Benchmark is telling you.
Yeah, I mean, I think importantly, you know, that's our base case demand scenario as well. Any sort of supply response, we'll see kind of higher price forecast expectations. I think as well, you know, you mentioned earlier, Howard, the kind of iron ore analogy, and this might be a good time to bring it up because it's a good way to kind of compare the way China operates to the way that Western markets are going to operate. And I think there are still some parallels that can be drawn between lithium and kind of early stages of the iron ore boom, not necessarily in the way that the market and production works. I think, you know, the aluminium analogy is fairly good there. But more in terms of where we saw a cost of production for many of the Chinese ore producers to be a floor. And in reality, iron ore prices spent extended periods below that cost level and price floor. And you know, the challenge with China is very, very cheap access to capital. And a drive to maintain jobs as well. You know, you rarely see kind of Chinese producers let go of staff. They might be kind of temporarily suspended at operations and sent home for kind of extended holiday periods. But you don't often see kind of job cuts. And often that results in kind of the high-cost Chinese mica producers operating for longer than some might expect. And the way to kind of combat that in Western markets will be to kind of support the continuation of operations even in periods of low prices. I think it's an easier thing to do in the Chinese market because a lot of the biggest high cost hard rock producers are highly vertically integrated. So if they're making losses, in the upstream of their supply chain, those losses can just kind of be passed through and essentially evaporate as you travel through their supply chain. But the difficulty with the kind of lot of the Western world is that there isn't this high level of vertical integration where losses can kind of just be passed through an internal supply chain, which makes it a lot harder to push through low price cycles. We've seen it recently with kind of the low nickel price. Australia put nickel on the critical minerals list. That might not necessarily make, you know, operating costs easier for the big nickel miners in Australia. There's no kind of subsidies being handed out to kind of counteract that. But it does kind of help with kind of job retention support and offer kind of some form of optimism to the industry, essentially. So I think that's really where the challenge lies, is the ability for China to kind of power through periods of low prices where the economics become a lot more challenging for Western companies.
You're talking about vertical integration. You're basically saying like CATL and BYD own mines so they could absorb those costs. Simon and Benchmark have argued for a long time that auto OEMs, battery OEMs need to become miners. So going back to my question, if your price forecasts are below incentive economics and the suppliers don't want to supply in that regard, it's either price floors, right, at a higher level, or GM, Ford need to start buying more mines. So GM is, in Lithium Americas. We'll see if that gets a big loan. And then they'll put in a second tranche, but they could own as much as 30% of Lithium Americas. Do you think are you advising when Benchmark consults with auto OEMs that they actually are going to have to buy upstream mines and pursue the strategies like Tesla and Corpus Christi for hydroxide?
I think, like you've said, you know, Benchmark has long advocated for the importance of kind of vertical integration in these supply chains. And I think lithium and the battery industry as a whole has to operate differently because of, you know, the requirements in the battery space. Life becomes a lot easier when you're vertically integrated because you're qualifying your own material. You can tweak your own production routes, your own production lines to the material that you're producing for yourself. You don't have to face kind of the pressures of a squeezed cathode market where a lot of the cathode producers are facing pressure from both above and below to reduce costs as much as possible. And then the pushback from that, and then you get the same pushback from the cell manufacturers if you're an EV manufacturer. Vertical integration kind of resolves a lot of those challenges, but it all feeds back to, you know, the difficulties of how long it takes to bring these new projects to market. So if you're a big major Western automaker, you know, you're going to have wanted to get involved with the upstream kind of yesterday, not tomorrow. But I think that's still, you know, a key trend that we will see play out and we continue to see play out in the lithium space.
Okay. In terms of like African supply, I mean, I don't know if you can go into any details of your model. Like how do you see African supply, you know, this year, next year, lepidolite out of China? What are your demand forecasts? You know, as I said, Goldman is like 1.1. I think Rodney is 1.2 this year. Could you address those specifically?
Yeah, sure. So we have seen and kind of continue to expect to see African production to raise fairly sharply. Our estimates are around 100,000 tons LCE out of Africa this year, which is, you know, still a huge ramp up. Considering that Africa wasn't even in the supply picture a couple of years ago in the lithium space, really, bar kind of a handful of projects. And same with kind of China as well. You know, we do continue to see domestic supply pick up. I think a lot of the good quality, efficient spodumene operations in China are largely up and running and under ownership. We continue to see kind of announcements from lower quality mica projects that still form kind of upper end the cost curve. And I think, you know, for those looking to switch from high cost mica in Jiangxi province, for example, looking back to Africa, you know, large Chinese owned projects, lots of them in Zimbabwe. Do form a lower cost option. But, you know, there's still kind of lots of ramp up happening within that supply chain. In terms of demand, we have very similar figures to Rodney, about 1.2. We see supply just over that level in 2024. So that kind of small market surplus that we're anticipating, which I think is a surplus that could very easily be threatened depending on, firstly, what happens with demand. You know, we are seeing sell costs come back down quite sharply now. And if that drives, you know, a real push downstream, then that could, you know, easily kind of challenge how balanced the market is. I think, you know, we're still seeing an aggressive EV strategy in China. We're seeing a lot of competition between EV manufacturers in China to have the best vehicle at the best price. And I think, you know, if there's continued kind of cost-cutting efforts on that front, that could easily kind of push demand up quite a bit further. And, you know, although the supply response has been small so far, and I don't think, at least for the time being, it's going to be huge because of what I've spoken about with regard to kind of Chinese producers tending to push through periods of a low price environment. I think, you know, a fair amount still hangs in the balance in regard to how much of a surplus there will be. But that being said, I think it will, you know, still be a softer year than we've seen in the last couple of years. There's no use denying that. We see kind of more stability in pricing. But the Chinese market can, I think, can always shock. You know, just in the last week alone, we saw Chinese carbon prices climb by 11%. Albeit obviously from a low base, and really kind of in response to what's going on with Jiangxi at the moment and those environmental inspections that seem to happen every year, and the short memory of the market means that they forget that they happen every year. But it's still a very, very volatile space to be operating in.
So, Daisy, you know, having a look at China exports of vehicles, they've come up out of nowhere from being an also ran to the biggest exporter of cars in total last year. I think 1 million of the four were EVs. This year, if you looked at the production growth forecast from BYD and the other major players, and you look at China domestic demand growth estimates, it looks like it's going to be a bumper export year for China, possibly as high as 2 million. Your thoughts on how that's going to evolve? I think I stand corrected, but I think the rest of the world outside of the major markets saw an EV sales growth rate of 100% last year, but over. So it looks like we could be in for another big year. Your thoughts on that market and possibly China's dominance before the West wakes up to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be another good year for the EV market, regardless of what we've been seeing in kind of terms of raw material prices. I think the challenge again goes back to just how sensitive these markets are. I think there was, you know, some levels of disappointment in terms of lower than expected figures in Q4 last year. And a lot of that kind of fed into this negative demand sentiment. I think there is still a decent kind of downstream inventory in the Chinese market as well. There's a good amount of kind of finished cell material that we see in the market that is being worked through. But I think that could be worked through fairly quickly if kind of the EV market stays on the trajectory that we've seen so far this year. And I think, you know, there's been a lot in the news about Western automakers struggling and clearly, you know, the, like you said, Rodney, the export of Chinese EVs has increased in pace massively. I mean, just outside the benchmark office, there's a big billboard on a roundabout. And, you know, historically, it's always been adverts for Tesla, for Ford, for GM. And over kind of the last 6 months or so, every time I look up at it, there seems to be a BYD advert. And I don't think I'd ever seen a BYD advert in the UK before until kind of halfway through last year. And now, you know, you see kind of a lot of the big Chinese automakers advertising and kind of pushing for market share not only within China, but outside of China. So I think, you know, that goes to show the ambition of the Chinese EV market, and kind of the strength we continue to expect to see. I think the challenge is that even kind of slightly lower than expected figures, if the market have got their kind of heads on a number, and then you see a slight undercut of that figure, there's a very quick response and fears that the market isn't doing as well as expected. And that's why you see kind of these rash responses whenever demand isn't quite where it's at. But we still see, you know, very, very strong growth in the market and improving penetration rates kind of globally.
And U.S. politics and the U.S. market for EVs, how that might play out this year. Benchmark has their June conference in Washington, D.C. I hope to be there again this year. And, but yeah, we just had the State of the Union address yesterday. It is definitely a Biden-Trump rematch. It looks like a coin flip, as to, I mean, depending on what polls you look at, but, can't always believe these polls. But it's definitely going to be, you know, I don't know, 6 months of volatility on the U.S. side, and EVs and batteries are a very significant component of Bidenomics, you know, both on the positive from the Democrat side, but also there is significant resistance on the Republican side toward this agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I won't claim to be an expert on U.S. politics, but kind of the discussions that we've had around it at Benchmark is that a lot of kind of the incentives that the IRA has laid out benefit what are traditionally Republican states. There's been a lot of investment, a lot of job creation in, you know, historically Republican areas. You know, what Trump, if he gets into power, decides to do with the IRA, you know, I don't have a crystal ball. But I think, you know, a lot of the kind of discussion I've heard seems to be around having choice over, you know, what vehicle you choose to drive. So a lot of it will be down to kind of the end consumer, perhaps, rather than being mandated by the politicians. And that's where we've seen differences generally in policy. If you kind of compare the US to the EU, for example, the IRA really kind of incentivizes the kind of build out of the supply chain, whereas the EU have kind of taken a more mandated approach in terms of kind of expectations on content for cell production in terms of raw materials and component manufacturing and stuff like that. So, you know, it may come down to consumer desire, which is very different in the US. The distance that you guys want to drive is not the distance that we want to drive in the UK. But, you know, that goes into the kind of interesting story behind different chemistries and what will thrive in the US as well. So I think hard to say until we know how everything pans out in the US. But I think, you know, there's been a lot of progress in terms of market penetration over the last few years in North America, in Europe, in kind of all the major Western economies. And I think naturally, you know, some of that will kind of snowball by itself as uptake increases. That's what we saw in China. Once you reach kind of a certain penetration rate, growth kind of becomes, you know, self-sufficient, essentially, rather than being pushed by policy.
Okay, great. You have a train to catch, Daisy. Have you thought about what music we should have here?
I feel like, because it's International Women's Day, we should do Man, I Feel Like a Woman by Shania Twain.
All right, we'll do that. I have a particular proclivity lately for Dua Lipa, but we're going to use her sometime in the future.
Oh, good.
But,
well, feel free to use Dua Lipa. I watched her at the Brit Awards the other week, and she got a great performance.
No, in honor of PDAC, I think Shania Twain is a Canadian, so we'll use her rather than the Albanian Brit Dua Lipa. we'll save that for another time. But I do want to just say to all of our viewers, since the beginning of the year, we've had very much analyst-focused commentary, both sell-side analysts and price reporting agencies and the like. But beginning Monday, we are going to pivot to having corporate interviews, starting with a major CEO in the lithium space who we've never had on the program before. We'll leave it at that as a mystery to viewers. But if you want to comment with a guess of who that guest might be, we'll be publishing it sometime in the middle or late or next week. Please reference that in the comments. So again, thank you, Daisy, and have a great weekend and a great
Thank you, Howard. Thanks, Rodney.